This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Detroit, the cradle of the American auto industry, has just declared bankruptcy. We'll talk with Professor Laura Bartel about what this means.
They bailed out the car companies, but what about the workers who may lose their pensions and health care?
We'll talk about the terrorist watch list and the no-fly list.
What's the no-fly list about? Do you get on the list because you won't be an informant for the FBI?
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Today we're joined by Shane Catadol from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Shane represents, along with the Center, a number of Guantanamo detainees. Recently, in fact, this week as we're recording this show, one of the Center's clients, a man named, I never can pronounce the name, but it's last name Amezian. The first name is what, Shane?
Jamel.
Jamel Amezian was sent back to his, quote, home country of Algeria. The center has put out numerous alerts on it, saying he's in jeopardy, he's in trouble, he shouldn't have been sent back. And they've been fighting having him against sending him back for many years now. So can you give us a sense of who he was and what we're worried about with him being sent back to Algeria?
Sure. Well, so Jamel left after graduating from college, one of two people who are college graduates who we represented at Guantanamo.
He left
Algeria around 1991, right at the tail end of the horrific violence there with the GIA insurgency, right? You can understand why anybody young would have wanted to get out of the country then. He went to Austria, where he lived for 5 years until a right-wing party came into power and couldn't get asylum there. He went to Canada after 5 years as asylum claims there were rejected. He went to Afghanistan as basically, you know, kind of a country where you didn't really need a visa if you were a Muslim, as kind of a last resort to not go home. And then a year later, 9/11 happens, and he gets swept up along with all the other Arabs, foreigners in Afghanistan, turned over to the U.S. and ends up at Guantanamo. And he was cleared from a long time back.
Cleared for release, right. For many years now.
Right. Shouldn't have been there probably in the first place, but the question was always, where was he going to go, right? He desperately wanted to avoid going back home to Algeria, you know, because he remembers it as a kind of war-torn place. He's from the Berber minority there, and he's just not really known life as an adult. He has family overseas. He has a brother up in Canada, in Montreal. So, you know, there was really no reason for the U.S. to send him back to Algeria other than the optics of, you know, making some gesture towards closing Guantanamo. Both him and the other man sent back this week, Belkacem Bensaya, really didn't want to go back. Bensaya had family, a wife and children in Bosnia. He was more Bosnian maybe than Algerian at this point. He was one of this group of six who were swept up after the Bosnian Supreme Court decided there was no evidence to hold them, but the U.S. was, you know, determined to get their hands on these guys, claiming that they had some super secret plot to blow up the U.S. embassy. And, you know, 12 years later, the final blow is that they send him back to Algeria rather than sending him back to his family. You know, Jamel, I can say I met with him earlier this month. And, you know, what was striking was he's usually one of the most coherent of our clients, you know, easily the most educated, has taught himself English, you know, knows four languages, is usually completely sharp and, you know, was having difficulty conducting the meeting in English. I had to go to the translator a couple times, which usually at this point he doesn't have to. And just you could tell how afraid he was of going back to Algeria. And it's really a shame. I mean, there were plenty of countries out there, you know, we believe who were willing to take him on. And he was probably easily the most resettleable of clients in the sense that, you know, he was an easy case. He had worked and lived before in the West successfully. In Austria, he worked himself up from busboy to a chef at a starred restaurant.
So what are we worried about with him in Algeria, Shane?
You know, part of it is those fears that I just mentioned, but part of it is that Algeria has kind of a set system for receiving detainees. They stay in what's called preventive detention, or garde à vue in French, for 12 days. And that's basically a period where they're out of contact with the outside world. So first of all, we're just worried that here's someone who was greatly distressed about being sent back, and he's got no friendly faces around him right now. He's in secret detention, you know, worse than Guantanamo in terms of its transparency right now. And human rights observers can't get into Algeria. Habeas lawyers have never managed to get visas to go there. Human Rights Watch doesn't have on-the-ground operations there. Everything is through people who, at one level or another, are permitted by the state to work in the country. And that's really why the U.S. is willing to send people there, right? We won't send people to Yemen because we're not convinced that the government is willing and able to monitor every last movement of any man who's sent back. But Algeria, basically, you know, a police state, and so they can do that. And ironically, you know, this is where we've seen the transfers. And I think, you know, the Obama administration is very sensitive to letting months go by without anybody being transferred out of the prison. And so it makes perfect sense that the last couple people they've sent out have been Algerians. You know, well, now they're out of cleared Algerians, and we'll have to see where they turn next.
I'm interested in what people can do about it. I know the center has a whole bunch of actions about getting people to pay more attention to Algeria and what's happening to our client there. Where can I go? What's the website? And what do you recommend?
Sure. Well, CCR's own website and Twitter feed and Facebook feed and all those kind of things. We're at ccrjustice.org. We'll talk about the actions that are going on. I believe there's a protest at the Algerian consulate right here in Manhattan, and also one, a small one in D.C., I believe, happening. The information about the ones people can join up with should be on our website. And basically, the theme of this protest is we want to make sure that he's okay when he gets back, and they should release him from this preventive detention as soon as possible, since there's no real reason for him to be in there. You know, the other big concern is that one detainee who was sent back, Abdulaziz Naji, was, apparently sentenced to a pretty lengthy sentence, I believe, around a decade upon his return. And he was distinct from everybody else who's been sent back to Algeria and had been released from their guard of view period without a problem. He was distinct because he had, you know, made it quite clear that he didn't want to go back. And so these two guys who were just sent back, our client and Bensaya, also have, you know, they haven't said anything critical about the government of Algeria. And ultimately, their problems are not with the government of Algeria, right? Jamel remembers, you know, Algeria as being war-torn in the civil war. Bensaya has a family elsewhere, but they didn't want to go back. And our concern is that, you know, who knows what, you know, underlie Naji getting a long sentence when nobody else had any problems when they got back.
I think the State Department itself admits he was sent back in 2010, Naji, right?
I think it might have been 11, but, you know,
it was a little while. He's one of the people who they admit that it didn't go well.
Right. And you know, what that means from the government's perspective is that the New York Times wrote a very nasty editorial saying this was a completely unnecessary human rights violation, basically. So they got a lot of bad press about it.
So I think people calling attention to our client as well as both people who were just sent back is very crucial for protecting them.
Yeah, people have to pay attention. And the Algerian government, I think, now knows, as does the State Department, that folks are paying attention. But we've got to keep that pressure on them to make sure that things go well for him.
Well, Shane, thank you very much. We really appreciate this.
Thanks, Mike.
I'm sure, like all of our listeners, it was very upsetting to read about the death of Nelson Mandela. The Times had a quick headline immediately after the death saying, "Mandela, South African icon of peaceful resistance, dead." Well, that struck me, and not well, because it's a repainting of who Nelson Mandela was. Yes, perhaps after he left prison, after 27 years, he then became an icon of peaceful compromise, peaceful getting along, etc. But before that, he was actually one of the founders of the military wing of the ANC. And now, our host, Heidi Boghossian, will read us a paragraph or two of his speech that he gave at what's called the Rivonia Trial. The Rivonia Trial took place in 1964. Nelson Mandela and others were on trial for the use of violence, for bombings. Here's the excerpt from the speech, which we'll also link with online, and you can hear the audio.
I have already mentioned that I was one of the persons who helped to form Umkhonto. I and the others who started the organization did so for two reasons. Firstly, we believed that as a result of government policy, violence by the African people had become inevitable. and that unless responsible leadership was given to canalize and control the feelings of our people, there would be outbreaks of terrorism, which would produce an intensity of bitterness and hostility between the various races of this country, which is not produced even by war. Secondly, we felt that without violence, there would be no way open to the African people to succeed in their struggle against the principle of white supremacy. All lawful modes of expressing opposition to this principle had been closed by legislation, and we were placed in a position in which we had either to accept a permanent state of inferiority or to defy the government. We chose to defy the law. We first broke the law in a way which avoided any recourse to violence. When this form was legislated against, and then the government resorted to a show of force to crush opposition to its policies, only then did we decide to answer violence with violence.
Thank you, Heidi. I also think we might want to read a section about his relationship to the Communist Party, but particularly socialism.
Today, I am attracted by the idea of a classless society, an attraction which springs in part from Marxist reading and in part from my admiration of the structure and organization of early African societies in this country. The land, then the main means of production, belonged to the tribe. There were no rich or poor, and there was no exploitation. It is true, as I've already stated, that I have been influenced by Marxist thought. But this is also true of many of the leaders of the new independent states. Such widely different persons as Gandhi, Nehru, Nkrumah, and Nasser all acknowledge this fact. We all accept the need for some form of socialism to enable our people to catch up with the advanced countries of this world and to overcome their legacy of extreme poverty. But this does not mean we are Marxists. Indeed, for my own part, I believe that it is open to debate whether the Communist Party has any specific role to play at this particular stage of our political struggle. The basic task at the present moment is the removal of race discrimination and the attainment of democratic rights on the basis of the Freedom Charter. Insofar as that party furthers this task, I welcome its assistance. I realize that it is one of the means by which people of all races can be drawn into our struggle.
Thank you, Heidi, and I recommend it to all our listeners. It's linked on our site. Listen to that Mandela speech, read it, and feel grateful that Mandela was there for all of us.
Michael, despite this country and really the world's reverence with which they held Nelson Mandela, he remained on the U.S. terrorism watch list until 2008 when George W. Bush signed a bill removing him from it. Why was he on the terrorist watch list?
It's incredible. I mean, you think about that. That's just recently. That means he was under that list when supposedly Bill Clinton, our liberal president, left him on the list. I mean, it's really shocking. He was on the list, I mean, in part because the U.S. never really, as a government, took a strong position against apartheid South Africa. And so why not leave him on the list? We did business there for periods of time, all kinds of relationships. In fact, he was on the list, of course, because South Africa, the apartheid government, classified the ANC, the African National Congress, as terrorist, and Mandela had been convicted of terrorism, what would amount to terrorism, in the United States when he was the head of the military wing of the ANC. So he was on that list until 2008. Heidi?
Well, it's also worth noting that a former UK Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, also described the ANC as, quote, a typical terrorist organization in 1987. refusing to impose sanctions on South Africa's apartheid regime.
It's not the only thing the U.S. did to undercut anti-apartheid movements. There was an attempt, at least not the U.S., but at least some of our presidents, there was an effort, and it finally did pass. The Anti-Apartheid Act was an act that was passed finally during the 1980s under Reagan. And that act did put tough new measures against South Africa's apartheid government, including a ban on bank loans and new investments in South Africa, reduction of imports, and prevented many South African officials from coming to the United States. Think about that first. That act passed in the 80s, but up until then, you could do anything. You could loan money to South Africa. You could do anything. But here's how the act passed. Our wonderful President Reagan was the president at the time, and he actually vetoed the passage of the act. And then Congress went ahead and passed over his veto by two-thirds of the vote of both houses, in which Republicans, many Republicans, joined to do that. Reagan, before that override, took his case to the American people in a live TV broadcast. He asked Americans to be patient with South Africa's apartheid government. He argued that the sanctions on South Africa would disproportionately hurt the black South Africans without helping apartheid. Of course, he was dead wrong. Luckily, the act passed over his veto, and the U.S. at least joined most of the other countries in the world in saying apartheid has got to end. But it's not a good record for the United States, not a good record for our presidents. And now, all of a sudden, you know, you hear people like Clinton calling Nelson Mandela his best friend. Clinton left him on the terrorist watch list.
Shameful.
This summer, we spoke with retired auto worker and activist Diane Feeley about plans to wipe out the pensions and health care benefits of all current and retired Detroit City workers by an emergency manager of Detroit. Last week, a ruling by the bankruptcy court allowed the City of Detroit to move forward in the bankruptcy process. This may mean the decimations of health care, pensions, and other services for many, many people in Detroit. It also may mean the sale of the Diego Rivera murals from the Detroit Institute of Art. To talk about this all, we're joined by Professor Laura Bartel, a specialist in bank financing and bankruptcy work. She teaches property, secured transactions, bankruptcy, and creditors' rights at Wayne State Law School.
Professor Laura Bartel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
Laura, the situation in Detroit is really quite extraordinary with this bankruptcy ruling. Can you tell us what went down and what's at stake with the judge saying that these pensions now can be on the chopping board?
Well, this has been played up as something absolutely extraordinary. It is the first time that a bankruptcy judge has held that pension obligations constitute contractual obligations that are subject to diminution in bankruptcy. However, most bankruptcy experts would have predicted that that would be the conclusion if it ever got before a bankruptcy judge. So although it's certainly rattled pensioners nationwide, it's really not that extraordinary.
You know, I sort of agree with that. I understand that. And so that's why I wasn't completely shocked. Of course, there is the Michigan Constitution that says that pensions are untouchable, but I understand that it's federal law. But I'm interested in how much we're talking about in pensions. Do they include health care? What's the number, and what's been the reaction?
No, the health care is something separate. The health care was never protected by the Michigan Constitution. Everybody has always known that health care was subject to modification by the city. That doesn't make it any less painful. And the cuts in health care are now proposed to go into effect, I believe, in February for city employees. But when we're talking about the pensions, we're talking about the retirees on both the firefighters and policemen's union retirees and those in the general city non-firefighter policeman plan. The city maintains that collectively those plans are underfunded to the extent of $3.5 billion. The unions believe that number is vastly inflated, is based on projected returns that are too low, but whatever the number is, it's a very large number, somewhere between $800 million and $3.5 billion.
And of course, what it means for an individual pensioner is really serious, because here they've retired and it's their source of income is the pension. And then what do they do?
Yes. In fact, the policemen and firefighters do not have the benefit of Social Security. Most of the other pensioners do have the benefit of Social Security in addition to their pensions. However, the average pension for the non-policemen and firemen is $19,000 a year. And for the policemen and firemen, I believe it's about $34,000 a year. So you're not talking about a lot of money going out to any particular individual. So if you cut the pension to any particular individual, it's obviously going to be a major cut for that individual.
Let's step back for a second and talk about how Detroit ended up in this situation. As I understand it, the definition of bankruptcy is that the entity is unable to pay their bills as they become due. So my question, Laura, is how did Detroit end up in the situation where it couldn't pay its bills?
Well, it was a mixture of events, of course. But the major problem that Detroit has suffered is a vast decline in population. It used to be a much, much larger city. Its footprint is still a very large city, but the number of people living in that footprint is much, much smaller than it used to be. And among that smaller population is an even smaller number of people who are actually working and paying taxes. So the amount of money coming in to meet the obligations of Detroit has been constantly shrinking by just amazing percentages, even over the last 10 years, whereas the obligations that the city has, not only to its retirees, although that its obligations to its retirees in terms of pensions and health care is up around 38% of its total obligations, I believe, and rising constantly. But the obligations just to pay for goods and services is, of course, rising every year, as it does everywhere, and the money was going down. So you have that basic financial problem, and in addition, we had severe mismanagement of city government, including criminality. I'm sure everyone knows that our former mayor is now in prison.
What bothers me is the equivalency here. On the one hand, these people who have pensions of $19,000 or $34,000 have medical plans. They're going to get cut. And they didn't bargain for that when they went to work. They thought they were going to get a pension when they got old. And on the other hand, you've got the bondholders who lent money to the city of Detroit, and they got back a bond for their loan. And that was a risk, as any kind of investment in stock a bond is. Nevertheless, both the retirees are going to get cut, and they didn't expect that, and the bondholders are going to get cut, and that was the risk they took. How do you balance that? Is there an equivalency here?
Well, when you talk about legal position, all of those creditors that you name, as well as anybody else who provided goods or services to the city and has not been paid, all of those fall in the legal classification as of unsecured creditors. That does not mean that they are all going to be treated the same. The emergency financial manager, Kevin Orr, has made it quite clear, as has Judge Rhodes, who wrote the eligibility opinion, that he has a lot of concern for the pensioners. And if you were asking for my guess is that they will be hit far less severely than the bondholders for exactly the reasons that you just said, that bondholders are making an investment and taking a risk. But anyone who provides goods or services or money to the city is expecting to get it back. So that's what bankruptcy is about. It's all people who have become creditors of the city, have done something to become creditors of the city, and they're not going to get what they deserve. That's the problem. Is everybody is deserving. Everybody should get paid, and everybody is going to have to suffer to some extent.
I have a question about pensions and maybe related to health care also.
Yeah.
When you're putting money aside or the union has to deal with the city,
that money is paid in for pension or for health care. Isn't there a separate fund set up for like a pension fund? Like you
There's
gave me the
pension fund, yeah.
Right, you gave me the number 800 million versus 3.5 of how much the obligations are. So there's a pension fund. So it's a little different to me than a general obligation that the city has.
But nobody's going to take away the pension fund.
Oh, I see. Okay,
that's not the problem.
So what's
they certainly are entitled to what's in the pension fund.
Uh-huh.
The problem is that what is owed, projected into the future, is far more. That's what this unfunded obligation,
gotcha,
anywhere between $800 million and $3.4 billion. That's the amount that's not in the pension fund,
okay,
but has been contractually obligated to pay.
For listeners who just tuned in, we're speaking with Professor Laura Bartel from the law school at Wayne State in Detroit about the bankruptcy that's been declared in Detroit. Laura, let me ask you this, if we could step back politically. It looks to us, you've got this Governor Rick Snyder who kind of came into office along with the Tea Party, white man, and you've got a pretty much black city in Detroit. And you have a governor who's really taken away the democratic rights of the citizens of Detroit. They elected a mayor who evidently doesn't have much power relative to the people that are administering the bankruptcy. And the whole thing looks scary and undemocratic. Is that the way people are perceiving it in Michigan?
Certainly that's the way the Detroiters perceive it. But in order to react to that, you really have to understand the background of the emergency manager law. The problem is not that suddenly the governor has taken away the democratic rights of the city of Detroit. We've had an emergency manager law for many, many years in the state of Michigan, under which a financially distressed municipality or Detroit is not the first one. A financially distressed municipality goes through various layers of having a financial distress declared, and then you have you try to work out a plan with the state, and so on and so on. And after various layers, the very last step is the appointment of an emergency manager, who then tries to deal with the financial distress. Other cities have had financial managers appointed. And Detroit is just the latest and the biggest to have that happen to the city. Obviously, a financial manager is not elected by the citizens of that city, but this is a statute that was enacted by the state legislature, and the state legislature represents the citizens of the state. So it's not some anti-democratic scheme aimed at the city of Detroit. This is just the process that happens under the emergency manager law.
Let me ask you about what's going on right now with sort of organizing unions, municipal unions and otherwise. Is there a lot of negotiations, opposition going on? Are people not in the streets necessarily, but is there a lot of outcry about what's going on with the health care, with the pensions?
Well, there are basically three things going on. Number one, on the streets. There were a lot of demonstrators outside the courthouse on Tuesday when the judge announced his eligibility ruling from the bench. Very unhappy pensioners, for the most part. Those public demonstrations are by people who know that they are at risk of having their health care and their pensions hurt by the city in this process. The second stage is the representatives of these people, the official committees that represent these people. Those official committees are, number one, appealing the ruling, which I don't think is going to be very successful, but they are doing that. But number two, and this is not talked about much, but they're in the room negotiating with the city, presided over by Judge Rosen, who is the mediator for these discussions, attempting to reach a consensual plan of adjustment. So there's three different tracks going on: the public streets, the official legal appeal, and the behind-the-scenes negotiation.
If I could switch the topic slightly to one of culture, the Detroit Institute of Art is one of the great museums in the country. And the New York Times ran an article 2 days ago about how the auction house Christie's here in New York had sent people out to make an inventory of the art at the DIA and estimate what the prices would be if this art was sold to pay off Detroit's debts, and then a comment that it looked like the emergency manager was willing to do that. Can you give us an update on that story?
The emergency manager has never said that he had any intention of selling the art of the DIA. What he has said is that everything is on the table, that he cannot take anything off the table at this stage. Now, there were comments. There was a rather oblique comment in the eligibility opinion where the judge suggested that sales of assets should be examined with extreme care if the asset might be necessary to the financial stability of the city going forward. Many viewers looked at that comment and thought that it might be the judge suggesting that the city should not sell the art of the DIA. He didn't say that, but it was read into that comment. What is all over the papers here is that Judge Rosen, again the mediator, is trying to encourage individuals and foundations to pledge money to the city. The figure that's been tossed around is $500 million, in exchange for which it is thought that Kevin Orr would agree not to ask anything further from the Detroit Institute of Arts towards the bankruptcy.
You know, it's interesting about that. I mean, we all love that museum. We've all been many times to see the incredible Diego Rivera murals there. But it's gotten an incredible amount of press, at least in our New York Times, much more than I think people losing their pensions or health care. It's just every time there's pictures. Last week there was pictures of the murals. That I find pretty interesting. And the second thing, which I'm not sure you want to express an opinion about, but if I look at it in a certain way, yes, I understand they want to keep the museum because in the future that's the core of a Detroit going forward. But on the other hand, if you're sitting there as a pensioner and you said that the shortfall might be only $800 million, and not only, but in the pension fund, selling the museum art may just restore the pension completely.
Well, Kevin Orr has made it clear it's not a bilateral decision. Sell the art, give it to the pensioners. That's not the way bankruptcy works.
Right, I understand.
If he sold the art. Incidentally, if he sold the art, he can't sell all of the art because some of the art was donated on condition that it not be sold. If he sells any of the art, the museum is probably dead because all of the tax millages will be revoked, and no other museum will ever do any sort of sharing with the Detroit Institute of Arts because it will have violated the internal ethical standards of accredited museums. So the museum is basically dead if he sells any of the art. But whatever, if that happened, if he decided, okay, we're closing the DIA, we're giving away the pictures that we can't sell, we're selling the ones that we can, that money goes into the pot. It doesn't necessarily go to pensioners.
Right.
It just goes into the pot for the city of Detroit to try to allocate under its plan of adjustment. It's not take from the museum and give to the pensioners. It doesn't work that way.
I think that explains it.
Where do things go from here?
The next stage is the presentation of a plan of adjustment, which Kevin Orr has said he will present to creditors by the end of this month and will file with the court at the beginning of January. That will give us a very firm idea as to what he has in mind to satisfy the debts. It will be the basis for further negotiations, both behind doors and publicly, between the creditor groups and the city of Detroit.
Professor Laura Brautel, it's been a pleasure having you on Law and Disorder. We thank you very much for your informed opinion, and we'll keep in touch with you as this story develops. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don't forget
You're
to get
welcome.
That last visit into the museum.
Okay.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
governments compile lists called no-fly lists of individuals, often placed on terrorist watch lists. As we've seen, the predictions about individual behavior of Muslims, communists, or Japanese Americans have often been wildly inaccurate and cause a great deal of harm to these communities. Today, to discuss the no-fly list and a recent case that's proceeding through the courts, is returning guest Shane Kadidal, Senior Managing Attorney of the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. Shane Kadidal, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Today we wanted to talk to you about something that I think is on some people's minds, especially lately with a case going forward in California, and that's the issue of terrorist watch lists. What's the case that's proceeding in California? And then let's talk about what watch lists are generally.
Sure. There are broad sort of watch lists, and then there's the ones that people are probably a little more familiar with in concept, and that's what's being litigated out in California, somebody placed on the no-fly list. Now, there are two different kinds of no-fly listings, basically. There's what's called the selectee list, where somewhere on the order of tens of thousands of people are designated for additional security checks when they go through at the TSA. They don't get what you and I get. They get an extra degree of scrutiny, usually, you know, an extra pat down or something like that. And then there's a smaller list, which contains several thousand names that sometimes you hear referred to as a no transport list or just the no fly list. That's of people who can't board a flight under any circumstances.
Is that anywhere in the world or just in the United States?
Well, you know, for the U.S. list, it's basically no flight terminating or beginning in the U.S. or going over U.S. airspace. But the U.S. shares its lists sometimes, you know, on a confidential basis with other countries. So, you know, we don't know how much sharing exists. There are sometimes cases where people can get on a flight from country A to country B and then can't get on the flight that connects from country B to the U.S. But as far as we know, it's, you know, at least directly it controls flights that either end or begin or go over U.S. airspace.
And these lists are confidential, so you can't really know for sure if you're on them unless, for example, you experience difficulty printing out your boarding passes in advance, things like that?
Right. Well, the government says that, you know, they can't reveal who's on the, you know, every name on the list because then Al-Qaeda would just go and pick the people who aren't on the list and use them to blow up airplanes, right? But it's simple enough to figure it out, right? If you buy one of those tickets, either that, you know, ends or begins in the U.S. or goes over U.S. airspace and you can't get on the plane, then you know something's up, right? So it's a little bit of a bogus secrecy argument. But the case in California is super interesting because the person who got stopped doesn't seem like the kind of person who would get stopped except for the fact that she wears a hijab and is Muslim. It's a woman named...
She got stopped. She wasn't allowed to fly?
Right. She wasn't allowed to fly. The story is this. She's a Stanford PhD candidate in engineering from Malaysia named Rahina Ibrahim. She was trying to fly home to do an academic presentation in Malaysia. She hadn't finished her PhD yet, and she was taking her 14-year-old daughter with her. Her friends dropped her off at the San Francisco airport. And by the time the friends were on the 101, they got a hysterical call from the 14-year-old daughter saying, my mom's in handcuffs. And what happened was, it turned out the mom was on this no-fly list, a list where you can't board the plane under any circumstances. The people at the airport apparently panicked and called the local police, who apparently panicked and handcuffed her. She ended up coming to nearly $250,000 settlement with the police over her arrest because she was, you know, basically someone who needed a wheelchair to get on the plane. She had just had a hysterectomy a couple days.
Oh my gosh.
Before that.
What
so
a
you
case.
Can imagine this woman who needs a wheelchair being hauled off by the cops as her 14-year-old daughter calls.
Oh,
right?
My
well,
gosh.
They let her fly out of the country. You know, the
Why
thing
do you mean
is,
they let her eventually?
Yeah, she got on a plane, I believe, a couple days later and flew with her daughter to this thing in Malaysia. But then when she tried to return, she was told in Malaysia that you're on the no-fly list. And then eventually her student visa was pulled. She had to complete her dissertation from afar. She brought suit.
What?
And the case ended up getting dismissed twice by the district court, Judge Duffy, finding first, I believe, that if you're a non-citizen, your constitutional rights end when you leave the U.S. And since she voluntarily flew to Malaysia, she only couldn't fly back once she was out of the U.S. Now, that decision and another decision kind of on procedural grounds ended up getting booted on a 2-1 ruling by the Ninth Circuit. And so it went back down for trial. And that trial is what started this week.
Wait, I'm sorry. The trial started this week, but what about the $250,000 settlement?
Well, that was with the local police.
Oh, that's
and
different.
This, this
okay.
is a trial going the trial. Against the, I just the, clear, the TSC, the Terrorism Screening Center, the agency that is responsible for putting names on the list, although it doesn't do much vetting. Basically, for all practical purposes, an FBI agent or any low-level official from any number of agencies can basically just say, I think this person should be put on a list, and the TSC doesn't hardly reject any of the nominations, less than 1%. The most interesting thing about the first week of trial, actually, is that that daughter, who was 14 when this all happened, you know, 8-9 years ago, is now a lawyer in Malaysia and was supposed to fly to the U.S. to testify and was told by Malaysian Airlines officials that you were on the no-fly list, and that's why you were not given permission.
Can you inherit that? Can the story get any better?
Maybe. You know, we used to wonder when habeas counsel in the Gitmo cases would have babies. There were two people with security clearance who had one. Could the baby enter, you know, the secure facility with derivative security clearance? But I'd be shocked if she inherited her mom's, you know, no-fly list.
So what happened?
Well,
so
you know, the government, of course, denies that she is actually – well, they refuse to confirm or deny that anyone is on the no-fly list, including her mom, the plaintiff. But for her, you know, they also seem to imply to the court this couldn't possibly have been the case. But, you know, of course, the Malaysian Airlines folks were the ones who told her that she was on the no-fly list, not the not any government officials. You know, that's another one of the ironies around
the
secrecy.
So what are you going to do now? But what are you going
to
do?
Well, I think they'll probably figure out how to video testify or something like that, which I
mean, she still can't fly to the United States? They
right. She was supposed to come in for, I believe, day three of the trial and was told she couldn't get on the plane after she had bought the tickets. You know, and again, Heidi, that's when it happens. It's usually when you get to the airport, not when you buy your ticket.
So tell us more about the trial. What's at stake? What could happen?
Well, so they're seeking damages, you know, for the fact that she couldn't fly back. And this is really the first case to get to trial, basically. There were a lot of procedural hurdles to get over. Congress passed a, what they call a jurisdiction channeling statute that says anytime you sue the TSA or challenge an order of the TSA, it has to go straight to the Court of Appeals. And so there was a question, well, all these other agencies you sued, are you really in fact suing the TSA? You know, and so that morass took up, you know, the years basically since this incident and now. The ACLU has a challenge going as well that is kind of a pure due process challenge, a case called Latif v. Holder, where they are challenging the fact that people get put on the list and there's absolutely no real process for finding out why you got put on, for challenging those facts. If it's an accidental kind of match, somebody else has the same name as you or a name that phonetically is close to you, you can go through this challenge procedure called TRIP, the Traveler Redress something something. And what they'll do if you kind of win your challenge, if they say, oh yeah, you shouldn't have been stopped, you were maybe a phonetic match, they'll give you a number that you can punch in anytime you buy a ticket. And if any of you buy plane tickets, you'll see there's a space to enter a redress number if you have it.
Wow.
That number is kind of a unique identifier, you know, not just your name and your date of birth, but this little number will tell the TSA, tell the airlines and the TSA that you're not a match to the name on the list. You know,
that's fantastic. So, there's this trial. You just mentioned a case on the ACLU, and then there's a CCR case.
Right. And so CCR and along with the Clear Clinic at CUNY Law School filed a case at the beginning of October. We were planning to amend the complaint, so I don't want to get too far into details about it. But the basic gist of the facts there are that people will either end up on the no-fly list, and when they complain about it, the FBI will come by and say, if you talk to us, you know, you can be taken off the list. If you agree to work as an informer on the Muslim community, basically,
wow,
you can be taken off the list. Or, you know, a little bit of a reverse situation, the FBI comes by and tries to convince them to spy on their own community. And when they refuse, for whatever, you know, legitimate reasons, they end up on the no-fly list. And they can't visit relatives back home. This happens even if you're a U.S. citizen. So unlike, you know, Ibrahim, who's going forward in the trial, a Malaysian citizen, this is happening to U.S. citizens.
Do we have any idea of the scope of this, Shane, in terms of how many people are affected?
Well, you know, we know about roughly the numbers because they're kind of annual or biannual reporting. You know, we know that they're in the order of magnitude that I mentioned to you, a couple thousand names on the list that can't get on a plane, tens of thousands of names on the list that gets extra scrutiny. You know, for me, the interesting thing about the couple thousand names is, you know, first of all, that is at some level much smaller than the number of names that are on these lists intended to intercept terrorism finance. Like, like the list that the Treasury Department maintains, which is like a 500-plus page phone book, right? But beyond that, I think there's this really interesting sort of, you know, notion that, look, anybody who flies on a plane nowadays is subject to those millimeter scanners, you know, can have pat-down searches if those don't work, right? You know, so at one level, you could imagine that there might be some logical rationale behind having a short list of people who get a little bit more scrutiny, right? You would hope it has more due process than the selectee list has now. But the idea that there are some people who are so dangerous that they can't be allowed to fly under any circumstances with any level of search scrutiny, right? That just doesn't seem to make any rational sense. And so it seems to fit very neatly into our complaint, which essentially alleges that one of the primary uses of the no-fly list is that because there is no process for getting off, because there are no standards for putting people on, it is tailor-made for law enforcement to use it as a coercive mechanism to go after people who have no link to criminal activity, like our plaintiffs in our case, and say, we're going to force you basically to serve as a spy on the Muslim community. And because we don't have anything on you, our mechanism for doing that is this listing process for a list that makes no rational sense, because, you know, maybe you'd be willing to be x-rayed before
Such
you go on the
plane. Such a gross outrage, right? My God.
What kind of relief, if you had your druthers, would you like to get, Shane?
I mean, well, we'd like to see an end to this, you know, coercive use of the list. We'd like to see, you know, at a minimum, some level of rationalization of this process. Although, again, I think, you know, I question really at the end of the day whether a list like this can ever really make rational sense.
Yeah, so do I. So, but what would you substitute for it?
You know, if law enforcement had evidence that somebody trying to get on a plane was actually a terrorist conspirator, they ought to be charged and tried, right? But, you know, one of the ironies of this list is that if you're on the no-fly list, like Ibrahim was, you get turned away. Typically, you don't get arrested. I mean, she was arrested because they made a mistake and the local cops overreacted. But, you know, the usual thing that happens is you try to show up and you can't fly and you lose your plane ticket, you know? So that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that's happened to, you know, some of our plaintiffs.
So having procedure rules would obviously make some difference because you at least know the process, and then maybe they can't intimidate you the same way the FBI can't. But what you're really saying, in essence, why should you be able to bar someone from flying if they're not being charged in a crime or on probation for something?
If they're allegedly dangerous.
Right. You know, and the government's response would be, well, you know, we expanded the use of this list after the underwear bomber. But, of course, the millimeter wave scanners were put in place after the underwear bomber. And if the list really is only a couple thousand names, surely there are a lot of other people the government might have suspicions about who will never end up on their lists, right? It's an easy sort of thing to circumvent at some level. It's pretty easy to tell if somebody didn't attract scrutiny.
Shane, has the Government Accountability Office weighed in terms of evaluating how no-fly lists are used?
Yeah, I mean, there are some GAO reports. Again, I think these things are produced every 2 years or so. There's a regular series of them, and they certainly show that there are a lot of problems in kind of implementation and process and all that, the kind of things that one would expect from a list that's pretty much operated in secret. You know, and again, that works this way, where, you know, an FBI field agent basically can pass information up the chain with really no review and no sort of skeptical questioning of it, and the TSC basically rubber stamps it, puts a name on the list, and then what can you do to get off? I mean, if you go through that trip process, you know, it just makes the agencies take another look at it. But they're never going to go and really question the underlying sort of account that was passed on by an FBI agent.
These lists are all secret. The OFAC, or Office of Foreign Assets Control, list is public. And one of the things that I've heard that people who might be concerned if they've been turned down, for example, for a mortgage or some other business-related application, is to check your credit report and see if there's a flag on it from OFAC, because apparently that might indicate that vendors go to the list, which they do routinely, and check to see if you're on that list. And if your name is, as you've noted, similar to one, there's a lot of, I think, bias in how that list is used by business people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this OFAC list, especially designated nationals list, it's kind of a master list of all the parties that you're not allowed to do business with as an American, right? And it combines not only kind of sanctions directed at whole countries like Cuba, but also the variety of kind of sanctions regimes directed directed at terrorism finance. So a bunch directed solely at Palestinian groups. And then the bigger ones like the material support statute, where foreign terrorist organizations, FTOs, are designated. And then one created after 9/11, where specially designated global terrorists, SDGTs, are nominated. This, the last time I checked the list, which is at least, you know, it's open and public. It's available for download every 2 weeks on the Treasury Department's website. It was 512 pages long, three-column, tiny-spaced phone book print, but tons of AKAs, you know, like every, again, Muslim name on there. Phonetically, it's hard to transliterate consistently from Arabic to English. There's no set way that people have adopted to do it like there is for Mandarin Chinese. So there are a lot of, you know, sounds like this name, sounds like this name, sounds like this name on the list. And of course, if you have a Muslim name, if it's pretty commonplace, then, you know, the odds that you're going to match something on that list probably pretty high.
Let me go back to the no-fly list for a second, because I remember reading about cases. I don't remember if you said where your client was trying to fly from, but where there was an American who stranded in Europe or the Far East, and they want to come back to their own country. They only went on a trip, and they can't get back, and they spend months trying to get back. And then somebody told me one of them, maybe you could fly to Mexico, and then you go across the land border to Mexico. Does that actually happen?
Or? It does, and it continues to happen, but does it get litigated? No. And the reason is the Justice Department doesn't want to litigate claims where someone can say, you basically put me in exile by putting me on the no-fly list. Back around 2005, I think, was the first time we at CCR heard about this sort of thing, where we had one U.S. citizen stuck in Hong Kong and two more in Bangladesh. I believe they were all Muslims. And again, the same situation. The FBI was saying, either you come interview with us without a lawyer, or we're not going to take you off the no-fly list, and you won't be allowed to get back into the United States, and you're so far away that there's no practical way that you can get back. And, you know,
honestly, story.
You know, could they fly to Mexico? I don't know. It depends on whether or not the U.S. is sharing this information with Mexico, and Mexico has a similar system in place, right? So, you know, all these people, basically, once they got lawyers, the government relented, and they got to get on planes, right? And there is a process for what are called one-time waivers, even if you're on the full-fledged no-fly list, right?
Is that crazy, a one-time waiver? You know, I mean, so that means that you're not going to blow up the plane that time.
Right.
Well, that's the nuttiest thing I've ever
heard.
I mean,
the government claims that there are all these rules around it, that they have to have like a couple weeks advance notice. And some of this ties down to like, you know, supposedly they'll put air marshals on the plane with you, and that's why they need the advance notice. Who knows how much of it is true in situations like this. But actually, if you look at the ACLU's complaint in Latif, I believe they had 12 plaintiffs. I think about three of them were in exactly this situation. And the case has bounced around for 2 years on all these kind of procedural issues that the government threw at them. By the time they got over all those hurdles, the U.S. had given them all one-time waivers. So again, these exile claims are not ones the government wants to litigate, but you see stories pop up every couple months about somebody who's in exactly this situation. And sometimes they worry. You know, they talk to a lawyer and the lawyer says, well, you know, maybe they've got something on you. Maybe you'll get arrested when you get off the plane. And so, it, you know, in effect, they end up staying put.
So you have all this litigation going on around it, which still could take a number of years, I gather. But is there any movement anywhere else in the Obama administration, in Congress, anywhere on this?
I mean, I think this is just like all the other cases where secrecy is really at the core of the defense of the program. I don't really see any give on their side. You know,
sounds like an employment project for overly scared bureaucrats.
Maybe, yeah, and a cottage industry for litigators, too.
So. Yeah, exactly.
Shane, it's been wonderful to have you again with us, and we look forward to hearing about the CCR case as it moves forward.
Well, great, thanks. Be glad to be back.
Thank you, Shane.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shane.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.